Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. 700 years ago, the leaders of Ragusa, now the southern Croatian city of Dubrovnik, were the first to enact a mandatory quarantine of incoming ships and trade caravans to stave off the bubonic plague. Historians consider that one of the great achievements of medieval medicine for how that decision slowed the plague and established social distancing as an effective anti-contagion measure. 100 years ago, during the last pandemic, social distancing and quarantines were less onerous. Long-distance travel was limited to mostly the wealthy, and the danger was mostly limited to big cities where people lived in close quarters, and those cities were nothing compared to how big they are today. Now that we're in the middle of the novel coronavirus pandemic that causes COVID-19, orders to stay home, stop work, and close down the economy have conflicted with everyday freedoms, challenging the ethics and the etiquette of our day. Jeffrey Seglin is a senior lecturer in public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. He's director of the communications program, and he also writes a weekly ethics column titled The Right Thing. Welcome to the show, Jeffrey.
Good morning, Ann.
Coming up in a little while, we're going to hear from one of the authors of an essay put out by the University of Pennsylvania, where they argue that protesters opposing state shutdown orders should sign a waiver to forego medical treatment if they catch COVID-19. Listeners, I'm wondering what you think about that. Should people who protest against the stay-home orders, people who refuse to wear masks at those protests, should they forego medical treatment if they catch the novel coronavirus? Give us a call. Tell us what you think. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Jeffrey Seglin, are you hearing from your readers about concerns and conflicts over etiquette and ethics with the coronavirus?
Sure, I'm hearing from my readers, I'm hearing from my students. I think most everyone I know is struggling with how best to do this.
How do ethics and etiquette anchor a society in ordinary times and then play out in times of crisis? It kind of gives us a structure, right? But
well, you know, the basic principle, I think one of the things I think about when I think about ethics is it's kind of how we decide we're going to behave when we belong together. And so that stays the same regardless of the crisis we're in. I mean, we saw this in other crises that the country has faced, and we're seeing it now. We're still deciding how we should behave when we belong together. And those norms are challenged because the pandemic changes everything that we've grown accustomed to. I mean, no one, unless they lived through the Spanish flu in 1918, and I think those people are few in number, has ever experienced anything like this before.
Right. And if they did live through it, they were probably very young at the time.
Right.
But we have history. I mean, we have it. It's written down. We know what we know. There's science, right? What's the difference?
I think one of the differences is we're a much more mobile society. We, you know, in the past, people didn't move around as much, both in terms of where they lived growing up, or in terms of business trips by airplanes or staying in hotels, or we're much more mobile and we're much more likely to be used to moving around freely. That's different. So it becomes much more of a challenge for us to, you know, even something as simple as when a century ago, when people used to go to the grocery store, they would put their order in and someone would give it to them. Mm-hmm. Well, we go to the supermarket now. We're used to being shoulder to shoulder with other shoppers. That's something that's new and different. There is, though, a positive thing to where we are. I mean, it's we're able to communicate much more now. I mean, if we had done what we had done with education, I can only speak to it from the college level, a little bit from the high school level. We were able to stay in touch with our students remotely by using a variety of platforms, which wasn't a possibility 100 years ago. If people had quarantined 100 years ago, they weren't speaking to people on the phone. They weren't speaking to people by Zoom or WebEx or Skype. Mm-hmm. So we do have that ability to stay connected now.
Excuse me. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Jeffrey Seglin. He's senior lecturer in public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School. He also writes a weekly ethics column titled The Right Thing. And we're going to be joined soon by an assistant professor in the Department of Medical Ethics at the University of Pennsylvania, who is among a group of University of Pennsylvania bioethicists who wrote an essay arguing that protesters who oppose state shutdown orders and gather against the advice of state orders should sign a waiver for going medical treatment if they catch COVID-19. What do you think about that? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There's so much going on right now, and in your ethics column, The Right Thing, in June, you write about the ethical dilemma that demonstrators against police brutality of Black Americans face during the pandemic. You reference the Ballad of Birmingham. What ties the two together?
Well, Dudley Randall, who's one of my favorite poets, wrote a poem called The Ballad of Birmingham, and he was basically talking about the civil rights. It was written in the 60s, and he was talking about the civil rights movement and how young girls wanted to go and join protesters on behalf of civil rights, and their mother was worried about their safety, so she insisted that they go to church instead. And the end of the poem is basically that they go to the church in Birmingham that was bombed, and they ended up dying as a result of that. So that the idea basically is that we don't know, even though we're compelled to sort of protect our children and to protect ourselves, we don't know where the risks are involved, and it's impossible to sort of predict what will happen in an effort to try to change the world or to right wrongs that are out there.
And now there's this double whammy of the pandemic.
Right, because we've got people who are protesting on behalf of anti-racism and going out, and even with every effort that they might have to social distance or wear masks, it becomes really challenging to do that when you've got thousands of people protesting in the streets every day for social good, at the same time recognizing that they are putting themselves at risk to do that and putting others at risk.
Exactly. I've noticed that a lot of people do wear masks at the protests regarding the police brutality, but still, it's just the sheer numbers are, and the more than just masks. I mean, the masks aren't foolproof.
Right. The masks aren't foolproof. Although at least the public health officials do say that if two people are wearing a mask, those two people, the chances of contracting the virus are diminished greatly. Social distancing becomes a real issue that becomes near impossible when thousands of people are marching together in a condensed area in the inner city. That doesn't mean that doing so is wrong. In fact, what many people are protesting for, and you could make a compelling ethical argument, is right. But they do recognize that the risk is worth, they do have to measure whether or not that risk is worth the value of what they're doing, and presumably they do, and that can be seen as an admirable thing.
Who sets ethical standards for society? What historically, I mean, we have you, and we have, you know, Mr. Manners coming on later, and
right.
But that's not where you're getting. You're not just conjuring it out of thin air.
No, I mean, it goes back to Aristotle and values and basically philosophers are setting about how we behave. But fundamentally, where we decide unethical behavior has to do with society and how the norms of that society establish themselves based on who's living in that society. That's why if I'm writing a column on ethics in the United States or Canada, it could be very different internationally, where the ethical norms are different. So the people living in the society sort of reach an agreement about what the acceptable behavior is. It's the place of comfort.
Are ethical norms that different from one society to the next, particularly given how much smaller our world is?
They're not that different in terms of the larger things. I mean, the stark areas of murder and issues like that where we can do that. But there are ethical differences if you look at business practices from country to country. There are differences in what's acceptable behavior still. That means that countries who have a higher standard of how to do business ethically, if they define doing business ethically as not accepting bribes, or what in some areas are called facilitating fees, mm-hmm. They may have an issue dealing with a country where those are a little more porous. So the big issues, no, we don't fundamentally disagree. This, the day-to-day issues, often we do. I mean, we see it in religious practices where some religions don't believe it's appropriate for women to shake hands with men. Mm-hmm. Some religions, in France, they've dealt with the whole issue of the burqa. So we see that sort of that clash there, where cultures kind of collide.
Right, and when those clashes occur, is that when societal norms start to shift?
Well, you would hope. You would either hope that there's an understanding that if you want to be a society that's welcoming and tolerant, you would hope that they would at least try to either begin to shift or at least gain an understanding of what someone else's perspective is. That there is no, as much as we'd like someone to give us a set of rules that are set in stone that everybody can follow, that doesn't always work. And it happens when, you could basically say there are laws we need to follow, or there are some laws that in retrospect we determine are not ethical. We see that with, in the United States, we've seen that on education levels with first separate but equal being established as a legal precedent, and then in Brown versus the Board of Education realizing that's not a way to go. So those laws shift, and we're trying to find an understanding of what's the best ethical way to behave.
What do you make of the controversy over whether and when to wear facial covering to stop the spread of COVID-19?
Well, if you're asking me on a personal level, I think science can be a great guide. In that case, I think that we do have a responsibility to not deliberately put our fellow citizens at risk. And if public health and science is telling us that wearing a mask can in public when you're within, I think they're saying 6 feet of each other, if that's a healthier way of being outside, I think that is a good ethical standard to follow. We have the freedom to do whatever we want, mm-hmm. With anything. I mean, we don't need to follow the speed limit. We don't need to wash our hands. We don't need to do any of those things. Whether or not that's the right thing, just because we can do it doesn't mean we should do it.
At first, the governor of Ohio briefly ordered masks in public places, and then the next day abruptly dropped the order, saying he misread the mood about it or something like that. I don't know what we're still unclear about what he actually, I guess he got some phone calls, but no one's really sure. Are people more compliant when they get to choose what they do? Because it really, I'm not sure that really changed people's minds when he dropped the order. I don't know.
No, I don't think they're necessarily more compliant. I think the thing that makes people more compliant is when they have a loved one who contracts the virus and decide, oh my goodness, I see what the issue is now. I don't think leaving it up for people to decide what's best for themselves in this particular case, because it's not just about themselves. If it was just them, people still have a right to smoke cigarettes, even if they know the health issues involved. Mm-hmm. People, but when they go into a crowded restaurant or they're on an airplane or a bus, they can't, because they're exposing other people to it. I think there's something similar a case here. If you don't want to wear a mask, stay in your backyard, stay home, stay out of 6 feet from one another. Mm-hmm. You have that choice. You shouldn't have the choice to put someone else's health at risk.
And then what about people who get judgy about it, for, you know, to grab the word, and I've seen in social media lately criticize people who aren't wearing a mask?
They have a right to have that opinion. That is a free speech issue.
Right.
I think that they don't have a right to physically accost that person, which obviously there's a kind of
a dichotomy there.
Yeah, there's a dichotomy there. Do you go up and accost the person, and thus you defeat the whole purpose of saying you should be at a distance from the person? But people have a right to express an opinion about that. I do wish, though, that they would stay by focusing on what the public health issue is. And that's where I think elected officials both on the local, well, not both, but on the local, the state, and God forbid we had some kind of federal guidelines that were more specific, those would be helpful. So we could all get some kind of agreement about how are we going to do this. I think some states and some localities have done this better than others. I think leaving it up to chance is not a particularly good thing. I also think making the decision about based on financial or votes is not a particularly ethical choice either.
We will continue our conversation. My guest is Jeffrey Seglin. He's director of the communications program at Harvard Kennedy School. But the main reason we're having him on is he also writes the weekly ethics column titled The Right Thing. We're going to hear from very soon an assistant professor in the Department of Medical Ethics at the University of Pennsylvania, where a group of bioethicists recently wrote an essay arguing that protesters opposing state shutdown orders should sign a waiver foregoing medical treatment if they catch COVID-19 by way of protesting. If you have an opinion about that, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll get to the calls that are waiting and lots more ahead. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The pandemic has evoked a host of ethical dilemmas, from medical decisions about which patient to save to social quandaries about the etiquette of wearing a facial covering. A group of University of Pennsylvania bioethicists recently wrote an essay arguing that protesters opposing state shutdown orders should sign a waiver foregoing medical treatment if they catch COVID-19 by way of those protests. We're talking about the ethics and the etiquette of the pandemic today. Still with us, Jeffrey Seglin. He is a senior lecturer in public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School and director of the communications program. He also writes a weekly ethics column titled The Right Thing. Dominic Sisti is an assistant professor in the Department of Medical Ethics at the University of Pennsylvania, where he also directs the Scattergood Program for the Applied Ethics of Behavioral Healthcare, and he is among those bioethicists who wrote that essay. Welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you, Ann?
Good, thank you. So you're one of the bioethicists that wrote that essay that the Philadelphia Inquirer called provocative. Why did you write it?
Yeah, so it occurred to me and to my colleagues, early on in this lockdown phase, that there were folks going out and protesting quarantine, and doing so in a way that seemed really dangerous. And it, began to really bother me because I started to wonder, what if these folks spread COVID or get COVID, and then they, let's say, appear in an ER or in an ICU, they get treated, but then, let's say a person like a child or a friend or a relative has the same symptoms, goes in, has COVID, but can't get the care they need because a cluster of folks from a quarantine protest have just filled your ER or ICU. That would bother me. That would make, I'd feel a little, as a parent, as a son, as a person who has lots of friends who are vulnerable, I feel sort of, upset. And so I sort of probed that feeling and came up with this idea that, it's really unfair that folks who are, essentially trying to undermine the public health mechanisms that we have in place would expect to then benefit from those same public health and critical care resources that are now scarce or that were scarce at the time we wrote the piece.
And could become scarce again.
And could become scarce again. And so it seemed to me an issue of just basic fairness. Where, it's a sort of a free rider problem where you have individuals who are attacking the system that they ultimately expect to benefit from. So, one would never say that they should be not denied care. Because physicians and caregivers should, we should always take care of folks and provide medical care. But it would seem to me consistent that a person who's protesting, very straightforward, as you mentioned in the beginning, quarantine has been with us for, 600 years. Very basic common sense approaches to what's a, once in a century catastrophe, a global pandemic, that those folks should really you know, think about the longer term implications of that behavior. And one way to do that is to say, okay, if you're going to protest quarantine and protest wearing masks and protest, you know, basic, you know, public health measures, consider a waiver for critical care if it is scarce. And that was kind of the goal of the piece, is to sort of provide that prompt
right.
to think a little bit more carefully.
Yeah, Jeffrey Seglin, you know, their triage is in particularly emergency healthcare is not new, but it's usually based on who's sickest, who needs the quickest treatment. What about this concept, at least?
Great. I get to.
I don't think that Dom's suggesting that you let someone die. The point is to get people thinking about how these things work.
Right. I think there's a chat. I think the premise of it and the provocativeness of it is great. I think the execution of it would be really challenging. Mm-hmm. I think though there's a parallel that doesn't go quite as far. If I'm a 2-pack-a-day smoker I'm covered differently from my insurance. My insurance premiums go up.
Right.
I think there's a way to if people first of all, you have to get people to be honest about it. If they mm-hmm. come down and contract the virus, will they acknowledge that they were protesting mm-hmm. this? But I think if they do acknowledge that and they do sign some kind of waiver that they're against masks and they're against social distancing and they're against the rules, there are precedents for that kind of stuff in terms of our insurance premiums, in terms we do already do something like that, unless I'm misconstruing what the doctor's saying. Already hold people accountable for the health choices they make about themselves, and I think this would what they're suggesting kind of parallels that to the extreme.
Yeah, Dominic Sisti, is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, I think Dr. Seglin's onto the point here, which is to say this is a sort of a free rider issue. It's sort of like uninsured motorists. We all pay an extra fee to cover people who don't buy health insurance or don't buy car insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Same with, you know, the individual mandate, if you remember, you know, the debates around that.
The way it was supposed to work.
The way it was supposed to work. And that's the goal here, is like a collective action to minimize risk for everyone. And when people don't participate in that, but then expect to be taken care of when the risk, you know, when something befalls them, that's a problem. And so it's important, I think, for it, just in the interest of fairness, to call this out.
Hmm. Let's hear from a listener, Christine in Columbus. You're on the air. Hi, Christine.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on your question about, mm-hmm. you know, should people have to say they won't accept medical treatment. I think that if you have to sign a waiver to participate in a rally saying you aren't going to sue someone if you get it, I think it's fair to sign up on a waiver, because we're not seeing a lot of these protests anymore, but we know that if we do have another spike and we have to do stay-at-home orders again, they're going to happen. Historically, we saw that.
Right, the shutdowns are kind of ending, but you're talking about, of course, the rally for President Trump coming up in Tulsa, I think it's today, and they're asking them to sign a waiver of liability. Yeah.
Yeah, I think if you're out there protesting it, you're asserting that you think you know better than medical experts. So to then go ask for help from those same medical experts is just, to me, hypocritical. And you see criticism, just real quick, on the mask thing. You see criticism on both sides, because I'm judged for wearing a mask. People think that if you don't wear a mask, you're disrespectful. And if you do wear a mask, you're stupid, you know?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people just think that it's made up or that it doesn't matter. And so you're getting criticism on both sides as far as that goes. Mm. So
okay.
That's my opinion.
Well, Christine, thanks for your call. I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm glad Christine brought up that current event of the rally in Tulsa. Dominic Sisti, I mean, is that a good parallel example?
Yes. Christine nailed it. I mean, she nailed the issue. The point here is, you know, these folks are in fact attacking our public health infrastructure. I sort of use a more provocative term of public health sedition. It's like they're trying to undermine and tear down our public health infrastructure. And, you know, they're going so far as attacking personally attacking people like Dr. Anthony Fauci and your own Dr. Amy Acton. It's gotten to be absurd. So that kind of behavior should come with consequences, or at least we should at least prompt people to think of the consequences before they, before they act this way. It's ultimately antisocial and anti-public health, and that's a problem.
I've been corrected. Thank you, Max, the intern. The Trump rally in Tulsa is on Saturday the 20th. Sorry about that. So, Jeffrey Zeglin, do you think that's a fair comparison?
Yeah, I think it is a fair comparison. The challenge, however, is that for the president's rallies, you get a ticket, and there can be a disclaimer, as there is with a baseball game or anything else that says that the protest marches against wearing masks, or the protest marches of any kind, typically you don't get issued a ticket. So there would be a challenge in getting people to agree to this ahead of time. But there is a parallel that I agree with entirely. I do want to correct the doctor. I'm only a fake doctor. I think he's a real doctor.
You're both have doctorates. So that's that. Let's see. Mike in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Ann. Some of these issues are very complicated, don't get me wrong, but there's one that I think is very simple, and it is wear a mask. I'm a veteran. I served during the Vietnam War, and I keep thinking, I served 3 years of my life. I sacrificed. I don't even need to go into detail about what all that might have meant. 3 years of my life for the public good, because it was the right thing to do. And when I hear people whining and what a big deal it is wearing a mask, I just want to say, grow up. If you are that concerned with how you look and that it might be a little uncomfortable for a couple of hours, you have a serious problem with selfishness and narcissism.
Well, thanks, Mike, for that call. I appreciate it. We have an email from Neil, who says, I have a question for your guest, Jeffrey Zeglin. I'm curious how he would compare the U.S. response to COVID-19 versus more authoritarian governments like China. Do Western values regarding freedom and individual rights hamper our response to the pandemic and lead to more potential deaths? What does he think of the trade-offs? And, of course, Dominic Sisti, I'd like to hear your thoughts about that, too. Jeffrey Zeglin?
Well, I'm all for being against totalitarian governments, but obviously, if you have a totalitarian government who's telling the citizens exactly what they can do out of fear of jailing or death, obviously that's easier. But mm-hmm. that's not who we are. That's not who we want to be. We don't live in that kind of society. But obviously, if there is that kind of society where one person or one government is telling everybody what to do, you can do that. Didn't work so well in China in terms of the initial outbreak of it, because there was also an effort to try to not reveal as early as possible mm-hmm. how bad it was. So there are differences and there are trade-offs. I think one thing to your previous callers, the Vietnam veteran gentleman who called in, I think one of the things that is remarkable still that I just don't understand why it doesn't get through is that wearing a mask it should be a simple concept, but people still seem confused. No one is saying that wearing a mask protects you. They're saying that wearing a mask protects everybody else in case you're asymptomatic and you could spread the disease. So it is a matter of protecting someone else as opposed to protecting yourself. Dr. Sisti could correct me on that, but I believe that's the principle. That's we're protecting other people, not ourselves by wearing.
Unless you're wearing like an N95.
Yes.
But yeah, Dominic Sisti?
No, that's right. I mean, either way, the N95 protects you and the other person. Mm-hmm. So I think the complexity there is that it is folks are asymptomatic. They don't, I don't know. But it seems to me the confusion comes from the idea that one can be a spreader when you feel fine.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
and I don't know that people have actually wrapped their brains around that basic fact yet.
Well, it's pretty simple. I mean, it's been reiterated
it is pretty simple.
Many times. Let's see. Got a few calls here. Jeff in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Ann. I was just driving in my car listening to you, and I found this concept very interesting, signing a waiver when you want to protest the health orders. And I agreed with the difficulty that would be to get people to do that. But I know a group that we could get to sign up very easily for this, and it's the Ohio legislators who were against Dr. Acton's orders. They could be first in line to sign the waiver.
Well, many of whom are still not wearing any masks when they are in session. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jeff in Westerville, thanks for that call. Dominic Sisti, that's a fact that the Ohio General Assembly, particularly the House, has been resistant to wearing masks.
I mean, the caller there is just spot on again, and this is a great idea. I mean, again, this stuff is not really implementable in a real sort of way. It's more of a rhetorical missive to get folks to think. But yeah, we had a similar issue here in Pennsylvania where our Republican state senators were actually not wearing masks, and they even had folks who had COVID, had tested positive for COVID, and they didn't tell their Democratic colleagues of this fact. So, yeah, I mean, I think that there's just, you know, from Donald Trump on down in the Republican Party, there's been a strange anti-science public health, you know, a movement that's imperiling really a lot of, you know, anyone that they come in contact with, and they don't seem to know or care.
You bring up an interesting thing, and I wonder, Jeffrey Seglin, if you could address it. It seems to me there were issues, and there were it might be that somebody had been charged with assault who engaged in intercourse with someone without telling them that they had the AIDS virus. Is there an issue there, Jeffrey Seglin, do you think, that people are withholding evidence?
I don't even know if you need to go to that extreme. I think spitting on someone is considered
which we've
assault.
Seen evidence of that as well lately.
Say it again?
Say people going up and coughing on people who criticize them for not wearing the mask.
That's clearly perceived as a sign of assault. And now people going up and coughing on people is seen as people can be charged or could possibly be being charged for that. If we understand that that is potentially dangerous from a public health point of view to someone and we're willing to do that, it just is remarkable to me that still that people...
That it comes to that.
Again, no one is saying to anybody, you have to wear a mask every hour of the day. Mm-hmm. They're just saying, if you're in close contact with people in a public setting, wear a mask. Mm-hmm. And it seems like if they want to make the argument, well, no one knows for sure whether that will work or not. Well, I'd rather take the risk that it works than be momentarily inconvenienced than take the risk that it doesn't and risk affecting other people or contracting the virus myself. Hmm.
Let's see, Joanna, in the Short North, you're on the air. Hi, Joanna.
Hi, Ann. I was just calling to speak to the concept of withholding medical treatment from people who knowingly go down to these rallies or whatever. Mm-hmm. And from a medical standpoint, that just isn't a thing that we do. It speaks to our desire for personal justice. And, you know, you want somebody to have repercussions for their actions. But we would not deny care to somebody who is acutely ill. And we don't generally function as a punitive organization with more, you know,
right.
Curative.
Well, yeah, Dominic Sisti?
Yeah, so that's been an objection I've heard, which actually misses the point. We don't anywhere say that someone should be denied care. That would be awful. No, that's absolutely, your caller is absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. This is not, we don't act in medicine according to political views or punitively. This is a call to the actual individuals themselves, much like an advanced directive would say, I rather not have ventilator support, I rather not have a feeding tube, whatever it might be, that this would be a logical step for someone who says, I don't want to play by the public health rules. However, I do want a scarce, you know, ventilator. That doesn't seem consistent. So to be consistent, say, I don't want to play by the public health rules. And to show you that I really mean what I'm saying, here's what I say. If there's a scarcity of, say, ventilators, I'll defer to, say, a child or an older person or someone else who played by the rules.
Let me hear
But no, there is no punitive nature here.
Yeah, and Joanna, I hope you're still there. What do you think about that?
I mean, it's interesting. That's not how I understood this to be implemented, but I still would say that it would be hard to convince lots of medical practitioners that the average person that is down there really understands and can consent to not accepting a ventilator or not, what the repercussions are of that and the likelihood of that coming to pass.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, Dominic?
Yeah, I was just going to that's actually a really good point. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, the question of whether these folks are fully aware and capacitated or have the, you know, are actually able to make an informed refusal about this issue. And that is a problem. You know, the essay itself doesn't address that question, mm-hmm. but it is an important question. How much, I mean, are these folks really fully aware and educated about the risks? I would say yes. I mean, I assume capacity and people making choices are autonomous, and, you know, that's the assumption that we make. But if in fact they are working or they are behaving under false pretenses, have been lied to, have been told by, say, the president that you should liberate Michigan, and that's influencing their behavior, that does definitely, I think, change the calculation here.
Hmm. Joanna, thank you so much for your call. Everybody else, the number is 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Coming up, we're going to hear from a New York-based etiquette expert known as Mr. Manner about you know, what common decency, what common manners play a role in this. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the ethics, the difference between right and wrong during a pandemic, and the etiquettes. Etiquette, how to greet someone, when and how to socialize, how to behave in public places. Still with us is Jeffrey Seglin. He's senior lecturer in public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School and is director of the communications program. He also writes a weekly ethics column titled The Right Thing. Dominic Sisti is an assistant professor in the Department of Medical Ethics at the University of Pennsylvania. He was among a group from there to pen an essay that argues those gathering to protest state shutdown orders should sign a waiver that they'll forego medical treatment if they catch COVID-19. By way of those protests. Joining us is New York-based etiquette expert, author, and consultant known as Mr. Manners, Thomas Farley. In March, in response to the coronavirus pandemic, he launched a podcast, What Manners Most. His syndicated newspaper column is titled Ask Mr. Manners. Welcome, Thomas Farley.
Thank you so much, Ann. Nice to be with you all.
So why do good manners matter, especially during a pandemic?
Good manners matter more now than ever, truly, because we are feeling anxious, we are feeling out of our comfort zone, we are in uncharted territory, all of us together. And really, regardless of your economic background, race, doesn't matter. We're all facing very, very similar situations anytime we go out in public. So it's essential that we do mind our manners. People think of manners and etiquette as kind of nice, fussy rules that keep people in line. And yet the reality is true manners make people around you feel comfortable, and that's essential at this time.
You know, I was really curious, and, you know, my folks weren't able to find necessarily evidence of this, but that manners back in the day, say the curtsy and the bow versus handshaking, was something about, had something to do with social distancing, but we couldn't find any evidence of that, that manners don't just come up out of thin air, just like Jeffrey Seglin, you know, I said, you know, ethics don't conjure them from thin air. They come from something, right?
That's true. And actually, just for your listeners, Anne, I'd make a distinction between manners and etiquette. So
okay.
Etiquette is really what you're referring to here. So etiquette is a code of behavior that governs how we act in certain situations. So, you know, if you're there as a guest of the bride, what side of the church are you sitting on? Doesn't really matter in practice, but the fact is, if you're sitting on the wrong side, you're not doing what everybody else is doing. So that's etiquette. Manners, when we speak about manners, that's really kindness, consideration, and thoughtfulness. Mm-hmm. So there aren't so much rules, rigid rules, attached to manners. And manners don't really evolve. Manners have been the same throughout history. Being kind to someone is being kind to someone. It's the etiquette, and it's those things like curtsies that you refer to. Mm-hmm. That really does change and evolve, and that's a good thing, because if you think of where we were as a culture even 50 years ago with regard to race relations or with regard to the way men treated women, that was the accepted etiquette at that time, and yet it really is unacceptable today. So etiquette can be an evolving, malleable concept.
So, Jeffrey Seglin, it's the right thing, right? It's all the same thing.
Yes. I think he's exactly right.
And the introduction to your new podcast, What Matters Most, says that as the globe grapples with the coronavirus pandemic, join Mr. Manners in conversations with inspiring individuals and thought leaders, helping guide us through this very abnormal new normal. You've done 13 episodes, and I'm wondering, what are you learning from your interviews about how to behave, about how to have, you know, be nice?
Well, it's been really fascinating, and all this was completely coincidental. Of course, my podcast was in the works well before COVID-19, as was the syndicated column. And yet, as I was co-launching both of those in March, it was very clear to me. I had a whole slate of episodes in the can and columns in the can ready to go, and suddenly the idea of, is it okay to bring a plus one to a wedding? These were not relevant issues any longer. So I really had to start from scratch. And what I'm hearing from readers around the country for the syndicated column, which is in Tribune newspapers around the U.S., what I'm hearing from readers is they're really confused. And people tend to fall into one of two camps, and I know you've been discussing that throughout the hour, is the, you know, kind of the mask shamers, right? People who are going around feeling that other people are not wearing masks and they're not very happy about it. Mm-hmm. And then the mask blamers, people who feel you're silly to wear a mask and why are you making everybody else, feel foolish for not wearing one. So you really have these two kind of differing camps, and then you've got everybody else in the middle who simply doesn't know what to do. So I'm getting questions on everything you can imagine, from what's the etiquette for attending a virtual wedding? What happens if you have a roommate and you have a pact to social distance and quarantine, and then you find out that the roommate has actually gone out on a date? What does that do to your roommate relationship? Mm. People who are working from home suddenly in large multifamily buildings, and they're dealing with noise issues that they never had to deal with before because they weren't
everyone's home.
That's right, exactly. So we're dealing with issues that do have ghosts of what we would deal with during normal times, mm-hmm. but with a whole different lens. And so for me, it's been really fascinating to explore these issues both through the column and the podcast. And what encourages me always is that people really do care. They want to know what the right thing to do is. They don't necessarily know. They might have a hunch. But the fact that they're writing in, the fact that they're mm-hmm. tuning in, tells me that they really are eager to learn, which is why a program like this is so terrific.
Which goes to your point, Dominic Sisti, that when you wrote that, the assumption is that people actually do know, and you wonder, well, maybe they don't know, no matter what we've done to try to tell them. I can't even tell you, literally cannot tell you how many programs we've had now over the last 3 months about it. But
yeah, there seems to be a sort of epistemic block on certain issues here with certain groups that just don't, maybe they don't want to get it for whatever reason. I do think there's some legitimate concerns and legitimate arguments about the lockdown related to, say, economic stress and mental health stress. But to protest it on the grounds of, assault on one's liberty, and then to extend that kind of claim to, like, mask wearing, just sort of smacks of really naive libertarianism or something that just isn't. It's hard to, as I said earlier, it's really hard to understand how that simple message is being distorted so egregiously.
Okay.
And
Jeffrey.
One of the things I agree with what Dominic and Thomas are saying. One of the things I do slightly disagree with Thomas on is that I do think the vast majority of people know exactly what to do. It's the people on the extremes that don't know what to do. But the vast majority of people know that wearing a mask is healthier. They know that social distancing is healthier. You can see that by the sellout of hand sanitizer, by the sellout of face masks when all this began to break. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of people do know what to do. It's the people on the extremes where all the noise is right now that are confusing people, and those are the areas where it's really difficult to grapple with. How do we get to them, both on the people who are shaming on either side and on the people who refuse to accept just the public health issues? We're acknowledging that wearing a mask helps.
Let's see, Paul in Canal Winchester, you're on the air. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I want to draw a parallel between our speed limits and adhering to those in conjunction with social distancing and masks. I am a person that adheres to social distancing. I have two different masks. I got a Buckeye and a baseball one. But I also think there's a parallel we can draw because I'd like to, I guess, to a certain extent, understand the other side's frame of mind when not adhering to social distancing and masks. And I think there's a parallel we can draw to adhering to speed limits. Those are actually laws, not even recommendations, that we should all be adhering to, yet most of us from time to time, if not regularly, speed. And I would also argue that there's probably a greater health risk to speeding, particularly on our highways, than there is to social distancing and wearing a mask. And I was curious, since there's such a big uproar about, and again, I adhere to social distancing and mask wearing, but since there's such an uproar with social distancing and mask wearing and not understanding those that aren't, isn't it really the same as adhering to speed limits and other type of traffic?
So if somebody's hauled into an emergency room who was speeding, got into an auto accident, they're injured, the question is, do they have the same right to emergency medical health care? Medical care as somebody who was maybe the victim, you know, who was not speeding in that case. And Dominic Sisti, I think you said that this isn't about withholding. It's about meeting out health care when there is a shortage.
Yeah, it's not about refusing health care. It's about calling on folks to decline it if there is a shortage. So it would be up to the patient, him or herself, not up to a doctor. And this is not about triage. This has nothing to do with triage. So there is a nice analogy. I would actually take it a little further and say it's more akin to an individual who drives drunk and says, well, it's my body, I can be drunk, and my car, I can drive it, and to hell with everyone else. Like, to that, to me, is more of the analogy, and we would never really stand for that. But yeah, it is the case that we all make bad choices. We do speed. You know, I've gone out, you know, forgot my mask, you know, with my kids on a walk. You know, we make these incidental, you know, mistakes that are, you know, more or less innocent. It's the idea that you're intentionally doing the thing that you're told not to do that's really at issue here. You're intentionally undermining the collective health of everyone, not because you've, say, just forgotten your mask, or you're taking a run and you take your mask off for a few minutes, but rather you've decided, I'm going to go down to the state capitol for a day and yell at legislators about these rules.
Paul in Canal Winchester, thanks for that call. And Thomas Furley, what you have the last, we just have a couple minutes left, and I wanted you to respond to that. Is that just beyond bad manners at that point, what Dominic Sisti just described?
I would say that at least some of what we're seeing with regard to the noncompliance is the guidance has been a little bit confusing as we've all been dealing with this over the last couple of months, right? As we remember, at first it was wear a mask, it's really not going to protect anything,
right?
But perhaps you should wear gloves. And then suddenly that flip-flopped, and it was, oh gosh, don't wear gloves, that's silly. But yes, definitely do wear a mask. And I think people are genuinely, in their defense, I think they are feeling confused. And I think to Jeffrey's point, I think people, they may at their core know the ethics of a situation, but as they analyze it and they're really trying to look at the pluses and minuses of something, and they really can't feel that they're getting appropriate guidance and wisdom from the health authorities as it seems to change. I feel like now we've kind of settled into a zone where, and I'm in New York, so we're all wearing masks all the time.
Right.
You see somebody not wearing a mask, it's a very unusual sight. So I do think when it comes to manners, frankly, even if you don't in your heart of hearts believe something is necessary or if you think it's silly, the fact is good manners would say if you're going to be around other people who feel differently from you, you want to respect their feelings of being right.
Thomas Furley, New York-based etiquette expert known as Mr. Manners, thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dominic Sisti, assistant professor of medical ethics at the University of Pennsylvania, thanks to you as well.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And Jeffrey Seglin, director of the communications program at Harvard Kennedy School and also author of the weekly ethics column, Right Thing, thanks to you as well. And thanks to
You're
all
welcome.
The listeners.
Thank you.
Thanks to all the listeners. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.